this idea is presented as though Muslims or Hindus or Native American religion, that there's something that they see there that's true and that's accurate. But in reality, that's not the case at all. The natural knowledge of God, what the pagans know of God, is only that there is a God and that they are sinners. And that's not a true knowledge of God. It's not faith. And because of that, they always end up worshiping creation and ultimately really worshiping the devil. There's only one way to heaven. And whoever denies the Son does not have the Father.
Well, that was soundbite number two, Pastor David Peterson on the natural knowledge of God versus faith. Soundbite of the week is coming up in the last half hour of Issues, etc. And we're going to ask you to vote on that or any of the others we're going to play for you between now and then. And we'll play them for you there in the last half hour, too. Dr. Ken Weeding joins us here in just a moment. We're going to be talking about the Reformation and weekly communion. Before we do that, we're going to have to cover about a millennia with him in a few minutes. Dr. Craig Evans will be our guest at 4:30. The Distortions of the Gospels by Modern Scholars is the subject of his book called Fabricating Jesus. We'll talk about all these books that are on the shelves now that present a new and different picture of Jesus with almost every chapter. Rocky Hulse will be our guest, Mormonism and Christianity, for just a few minutes in the 5 o'clock hour. He is president of the Nauvoo Christian Visitor Center in Nauvoo, Illinois. And then the last hour of the program, or give or take a little bit, we've got a very interesting comment from a listener to Sunday night's broadcast on evangelical feminism with Dr. Wayne Grudem. We'll play the comment for you, get your reaction, a little bit of audio, open lines, and then, as I said, soundbite of the week. LCMS World Relief is busy. We found out how busy they were last week when we were in Fort Wayne. One of their spokespersons spoke with us, and I didn't even know that they were working on this. I didn't even know that this had happened in Oklahoma, the ice storms that put so many out of power for so long. LCMS World Relief was there already trying to coordinate efforts between congregations and people in need. That's what they do. You can earmark a donation for LCMS World Relief and the ice storms in Oklahoma. Call 1-888-930-4438. 1-888-930-4438, or go to our website and find the LCMS World Relief logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Remember Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief. Dr. Ken Weeding is author of our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January. It's called The Blessings of Weekly Communion, and we're talking about the blessings of weekly communion throughout the history of the church. Today, the Reformation and weekly communion. Dr. Weeding, welcome back.
It's good to be with you again, Todd.
Well, I think we got to about the 5th century last time we talked, and for a lot of people, this is the way they do church history. They're really interested in about the first 5 centuries, and then not so much until the time of the Reformation, but there are 1,000 years.
And we touched on that a bit last time. For over 1,000 years, God's people had not been regularly communing. The Mass was viewed as a sacrifice performed by the priest at the start of the Middle Ages, about 3 times a year, estimated that people communed each year. And after those 1,000 years, probably from the 10th century on, one time a year or none at all. And the understanding had shifted that this is a private thing, a private mass, a votive mass, developed in the monasteries, worked its way into the parishes. And in a given parish, there might be 20 or 30 perhaps 50 masses said a day, sometimes a dozen at one time by different priests, but God's people were not communing. Votive masses were for special needs. If you were going to get married or wanted good weather or looking for safety on a trip or success in a business venture, and it was a very individualistic, satisfying of individual needs perspective, and it came from the misunderstanding and misteaching and mispractice of the Eucharist as a sacrifice that the priest did for the ongoing sins of the people. And amazingly, in that time, seeing the elevation of the host came to be the high point of the Mass. The people were basically spectators. Sometimes dark curtains were put in behind the altar. Candles were there to see the host more clearly. A bell was rung from the 13th century on, so people would know that this is the host now, and it is lifted for their viewing. But In this time, the laity, again, as I said, were not communing. Their participation, even when they were present, was more private. This is when prayer books, the prayer beads and the rosary came in, oftentimes to keep the people occupied because they weren't participating. They weren't receiving the sacrament of Christ's body and blood, but were simply watching what they believed to be a sacrifice being redone.
So we have an entire millennia, give or take, wherein the general practice of the church was to do everything regarding the Lord's Supper except receive it.
Yes, yes, and faithfully, daily, in the Western Church, Mass was celebrated, and of course each Lord's Day. But the people came to fear it. They came to view it as something simply to be watched and adored. There were parades with it. It was put on display at times, but it was not being received. The single service of Word and Sacrament, by which the risen Christ came weekly to teach and feed his gathered church after Pentecost, and for centuries in the early church hadn't been clearly proclaimed or widely received for about a millennium when God gave voice to Martin Luther and the Reformation came about.
Can you talk about, you just mentioned it in passing there, you said parades where the consecrated host would be walked through streets. Corpus Christi processionals were really a huge deal during this time. What was the point of this?
Again, to adore. They believed that Christ was present, as he promised, that this was his body. And they just simply lost the communal aspect. They lost the heart of the gift given by Christ, that this was for them to receive, to eat and to drink for the forgiveness of sins. And so the parades, putting of it on display, reserving it, using it for to grant blessing in certain ways, that was all part of the misapplication, misunderstanding of those Middle Ages.
So there are really two concerns here when it comes to the subject of the blessings of weekly communion. And one of them we've emphasized, and today it sounds like there needs to be an equal emphasis on the other, not only that the church offer the Lord's Supper as the church has always, according to the gift given on a weekly basis, but also that the believers in the church, the baptized, understand, again, the nature of the gift given and receive it regularly.
And amazingly, for Luther and the Reformers, it was quite easy to undo private masses. They just said, this is not the gift, and votive mass. It was quite easy. It was done with some rapid action on their part. They removed the parts from the liturgy that talked of sacrifice. But in the sense of having the laity commune again in a regular way, that took more time. That took teaching and that took instruction. And Martin Luther, that was at the heart of his work. From 1522 to 1530, he wrote more essays on the Lord's Supper than on any other single topic. Next to justification, the Lord's Supper is the theme that Luther wrote about most. And significantly, one of the most insisted upon reforms is that there absolutely had to be laity present desiring to commune. And we might think, well, how can that be so significant? Because for hundreds of years, they had not been receiving this gift. And so you hit the nail on the head, Todd, in describing it in that way. Not only that the church would offer the opportunity, but then again that the people would understand their need and hunger and thirst for that gift. And Luther made very clear statements about pastors preaching so that their people would press them and require them to serve the sacrament. That was all part of his teaching through the years of the Reformation.
Now, this is what I was taught, or maybe I just assumed it. I don't know. But before I came to the seminary to study to be a pastor, I thought, well, you had all this Middle Age stuff where it was Mass every day, and maybe the people weren't receiving it. But then along comes Luther, and Luther says, well, fooey on all this. And then he decided four times a year is good enough, and that was it. How did that get started?
Oh, that is an amazing, amazing misunderstanding of Luther. And he made that statement, but he made it in this context. He was teaching the people that they shouldn't despise the sacrament, that now that they weren't under the requirement of the Pope, they were misusing their Christian freedom and so forth. But he makes it very clear that the sacrament is celebrated weekly. But he said to them, unless you would commune at least four times a year, I don't know how you can be Christian. And I know in my boyhood that was misunderstood, and I heard it talked about in a way that is not at all in keeping with the context of what he expressed. It was not then for Luther saying this is a something of the gospel that you can get by on with this minimum. But it was really a statement of the law. He was saying, here is this gift, and it's set before you each week, oftentimes twice on Sunday and sometimes during the week, and it was always available also on feast days like Christmas and Easter and so forth. And he was saying, here is the Lord coming to you, and he comes to you and presents himself to you for your forgiveness. If you refrain from that, if you despise the sacrament and don't receive it at least four times a year, how can you be Christian? So it was really Luther speaking the law, saying, wake up and see the gift that's here. He was in no way prescribing a minimum availability of this gift as a gospel gift, saying, oh, we can get by four times a year.
In fact, tell us about this, please, with a little detail. If I'm not mistaken, the Lutheran confessions, in fact, boast to the opponents who would read them that it is the Lutheran practice after the Reformation to celebrate the Lord's Supper every Lord's Day.
It's very clearly stated in the Augsburg Confession that we celebrate the Lord's Supper every Sunday and on other festivals when anyone desires it. And that would be, again, the key. And, you know, this, Todd, was one of the major obstacles in recovering a widespread or uniform practice of the Lord's Supper each Sunday, is that the people, sometimes in a given parish, there would be no one who would come to commune. And then to avoid reverting to the private mass, the Lord's Supper would not be offered. It was for God's people gathered together to be received. And so there was no golden age at the time of the Reformation. It was a golden age of recovery of understanding and restoration of proclaiming the gospel and restoration of making available this wondrous gift. But as in every age, there was opposition to it, there was lack of understanding, and the Reformers pressed forward with clarity in the fact that the sacrament should be there for the people to receive. If there was no one to receive, then a private mass was not, was not performed or undertaken, but rather the service was done with just the word.
We're talking with Dr. Ken Weeding, author of Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for January, titled The Blessings of Weekly Communion. What do you think about weekly communion? Give us a call, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Weeding is pastor of Luther Memorial Chapel in Shorewood, Wisconsin. You can also email us, issues, etc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc., and we're coming to you live this Thursday. It's the 25th of January. Why did the Lord's Supper occupy such prominence, not only in Luther's early works, his theology, one of the greatest works he ever did by his own admission had to do with the Lord's Supper, and why did it occupy so much of Luther's efforts in terms of reform, that is, rediscovering these truths?
Luther described it, Todd, as the sum and substance of the gospel. This is where the Lord, who purchased our redemption, who cried out in victory on Calvary's tree, "It is finished," brings to us the fruit of that finished redemption. Here is the very body offered on the cross, the very blood he shed for us there, for us to eat and drink. How can the Lord come closer to us than he does in coming under the very roof of our mouths with this gift? And as Luther taught and encouraged and exhorted the recovery of the communing of the laity in a regular way, shortly after he reformed from the abuses of the Middle Ages, from the perversion of the mass as a sacrifice, then there were people who went further, who said, well, the sacraments really are simply our doing. They're not a sacrament as a gift from God to us, but they're our testimony of our action to God. And so he fought two battle fronts, one against Rome, and then almost within a heartbeat, then he was fighting also against Zwingli and those who said, well, this really isn't a gift from God. It is only a symbolic or representative thing. And so Luther's desires for weekly celebration were compounded by that double battlefront.
Talk a bit about the post-Luther Reformation era.
His death in 1546 brought almost immediate attack from the emperor and the pope within 5 months after Luther's death. Troops with lots of funds behind them from the pope took after Lutheranism, seeking to exterminate it, to stamp it out. In those years that followed, the Augsburg Interim, Leipzig Interim, these were agreements that were made to try to let the Lutherans survive, but under a rule wherein they had to resort to more of Roman Catholic teaching and practice. And also in these years, shortly after Luther's death, there came attacks on Lutheranism from the other direction, from what we call crypto-Calvinists or subtle sacramentarians, who from the inside the Lutheran Church said, well, let's not just emphasize the real presence so much. Let's not insist that this is, by Jesus' words, the true body and the true blood, so that that we can agree with and get along better in the religious climate and the civil religion. And those years were filled with turmoil and filled with challenges. The Formula of Concord in 1580 was very clear in restating the wondrous truths and gifts of the Lord and the sacrament, so clearly saying that this is what Jesus says it is. This is my body. This is my blood. And it's received not only by the worthy, but by unworthy communicants. It's not our faith or our thoughts that make it so, but the very word of Christ who is present, who comes among us. And so on both battlefronts, there was much to be done and much activity and a lot of turmoil in those years.
A turmoil a little bit later in the Reformation era comes in the form of a movement that not only infected Lutheranism, although it did infect Lutheranism to a greater degree than other forms of the Reformation, Pietism. What was it, and how did this Pietistic movement, that in many ways persists today, sad to say, in its vestiges, how did it regard the Lord's Supper, and what did it make of the practice of weekly communion?
Pietism really flourished, Todd, after the Thirty Years' War, in the early 1600s to 1648, in that 17th century. So much warfare tied to the confession of faith, Roman Catholic, Lutheran, Calvinism. And when that 30 years war came to an end, with Germany very much a wasteland, churches and books destroyed, the population decimated, Pietism really kind of flourished at that point. And it said, enough of the fighting, and we're the heart and center of the confession would locate the certainty of salvation within the human being, not on God's promised gifts from without. They emphasized inner experience or feeling. This made sermons very practical, how to do things. And it, in many ways, quickly tended toward legalism. It attacked a stress on pure doctrine. That wasn't really viewed by Pietism as all that crucial, but rather the internal aspect of the feeling of religion and of God's action in some way. And, of course, this led to quite a deterioration in the liturgy. There was less celebration of the Lord's Supper, less preaching on the Lord's Supper. And hand-in-hand with it was rationalism. Almost as soon as Pietism was reaching its zenith, rationalism started. It didn't really gain strength until some decades later, but it also attacked the sacrament and liturgical worship, confessing Christ's presence, not in the sense of inner experience or feeling, but in the sense of human reason as king. If it's not reasonable and rational, then it can't be true. And what's so important to note, a key to understanding this whole thing, whole thought of blessings of weekly communion, is that this is the seedbed for transporting religion and the divine service to America. Rationalism and pietism were very much undermining the historic understanding and Luther's recovery of this in the Reformation when immigration came to this country and Lutheran services began over here.
So with all that under the bridge, and that's an awful lot.
It really is. It's an amazing history and complicated and quite tragic in some ways.
It's no wonder then that even when Lutheranism, the Reformation, lands on these shores, they're not entirely straight on what the church, what the Lord's Supper is, how the church handles this, and therefore how it ought to be practiced.
I've kind of thought of it as being between a rock and a hard place. And pietism sought to rescue religion, but it really emptied the divine service from the inside with a more subjective approach. Rationalism elevated human reason as judge and openly attacked the sacraments, emphasizing more civil and moral and science aspects. And so in this century, the 18th century, when immigration was taking place, shocking deterioration in word and sacrament worship was at work in Europe. Hermann Sasse referred to that time as the dying of the sacrament. In some parishes, there was a decrease in communion attendance of 75% over a few years. And those two movements of pietism and rationalism were the main culprits in that great loss.
With only 20 seconds, is this why even today the misunderstanding persists, even among Lutherans sometimes, that the Lord's Supper, and especially a weekly practice of Lord's Supper, is too Roman for Lutherans to consider?
It's certainly at work, Todd. The anti-Roman Catholic sentiment in this country, what we call the pro-Protestant sentiment, was just amazingly at work in terms of our own understanding as Lutherans of the Lord's Supper, its place in weekly worship, and how often it should be received.
Next time with Dr. Ken Weeding, we're going to talk about the Lord's Supper in the modern era. Dr. Weeding is pastor of Luther Memorial Chapel in Shorewood, Wisconsin. He's author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for January. It's called The Blessings of Weekly Communion. Thank you very much for being our guest. Look forward to our next conversation.
It's always my pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
The Blessings of Weekly Communion is $23.99 plus shipping and handling. This book is a great resource, not only in terms of its history, you're getting a taste of that, but also you're getting a taste of the theological depth of this study of the Blessings of Weekly Communion by Dr. Ken Weeding. It's at our website, issuesetc.org. You can see a picture of the book there and a link to more information. You can call Concordia Publishing House and ask them about The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for January, The Blessings of Weekly Communion. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. When we come back, we're halfway through the program this Thursday, the 25th of January. Dr. Craig Evans is going to join us. He's written a new book called Fabricating Jesus. We'll react to so many other popular books that fabricate Jesus.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Hello, this is Kay Meyer of Family Shield. How do you respond to Jehovah's Witnesses who are members of your family, who live next door, who you work with? What about responding to those who knock on your door? Join us next time as I present Responding and Witnessing to Jehovah's Witnesses. I'll share stories of individuals and families we've assisted through the Family Shield Cult Outreach Ministry.
Family Shield, Saturday mornings at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
You're invited to spend part of your Sunday mornings with us here at AM 850 KFUO. Every Sunday morning, we bring you two worship broadcasts. Our early service comes from Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church in North St. Louis County at 8 a.m. The pastor at chapel is the Reverend Theodore Lesh. Our second service comes from Village Lutheran Church in Ladue and begins at 10:45. The Reverend John Temple is the pastor. We're pleased to bring you these two worship broadcasts every Sunday on AM 850 KFUO, inspirational Christian radio for the world.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Millions of uninsured Americans would receive coverage under a proposal unveiled by President Bush during the State of the Union. At the same time, the plan would fix an inequity in the law that taxes the privately insured for their policies, but leaves those who get insurance through their employers untaxed. Steve Jordahl explains.
Under the president's plan, the amount you and your employer spend on health insurance will be part of your taxable income. The money would subsidize coverage for the 46 million people who are uninsured and end the tax inequity. John Goodman of the National Center for Policy Analysis.
But at the same time, they're going to create a sort of a health care standard deduction that's going to be quite generous. So if you fall within $15,000, you will not pay additional taxes.
The bulk of the money would come from those who have what experts call ultra-expensive Cadillac insurance plans that cost more than $15,000 a year per family. Pat Toomey of the Club for Growth says the plan is good if it pays for itself.
He's come up with a plan that I think makes a lot of sense, provided that this is not a net tax increase.
Given the health care tax credit built into the proposal, middle and low-income employees would not see an increase in their health insurance costs. Still, Toomey expects opposition from the new majority party.
The Democrats are going to be very resistant to this. They are all in favor of expanded health insurance as long as the government's paying for it.
The plan should get public support from the 77 million baby boomers. 80% of them are going to retire before they become eligible for Medicare. It needs congressional approval before becoming law. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Another prong of the president's proposal would take money the government is using to provide free health services for the uninsured and utilize it instead to subsidize private insurance. The White House estimates only the top 20% of employees have Cadillac plans. They'll have the option of adjusting their compensation and lowering their premiums. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Sign on at 7:15 for information and Christian conversation on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO. Hi, I'm Diane Summers. Paul Clayton and I will be talking with Marty Lindfett from Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. We'll also talk with Gene Brady about Super Bowl snacking. And we'll talk with Deaconess Ruth McDonald of Salem Lutheran Church on their Mission Fest coming up. That and a whole lot more. It begins at 7:15 to 9:30, The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
Our book of the month for January is titled The Blessings of Weekly Communion. What benefits do we receive in the sacrament of the altar? The Blessings of Weekly Communion is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. You'll also find more information on our website, issuesetc.org. The Blessings of Weekly Communion cost $23.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
But I do think that what Christians believe today is miles different from what the early Christians believed.
How so?
Well, just pick your doctrine. I mean, Jesus himself, for example, didn't go around talking about himself being fully divine and fully human. The earliest Christians were apocalypticists who thought that the end of the world was imminent, coming within their own generation. They believed that dead bodies would be raised from the dead. They didn't at all think that you died and your soul went to heaven.
Some words from Bart Ehrman, author of the book Misquoting Jesus, in a recent Issues Etc. interview. We're going to be responding to Ehrman and others, what our guest calls fabricating Jesus. Dr. Craig Evans joins us for the next half hour of Issues Etc. We'll discuss distortions of the Gospels by modern scholars, Ehrman among them. Dr. Evans is a distinguished professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Wolfville, Nova Scotia, Canada, and he's author of the new book, Fabricating Jesus, How Modern Scholars Distort the Gospels. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Evans, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much.
How did the notions put forth and kind of typified there by Ehrman's comments that we've completely misunderstood what the early Christians were about and especially what Jesus was really all about? How do those things have currency today?
Well, you know, there's a little bit of truth in what Bart was saying. There is some misunderstanding, which, by the way, I think is what generates a whole lot of the problem as it develops down the road. He commented something about early Christians expected the world to come to an end. That's actually a faulty statement right there. However, there are a lot of Christians that did think that that was the teaching of Jesus and did think that that's what the early church thought. And so it's those kinds of misunderstandings which, unfortunately, some scholars perpetuate because they just haven't figured that out and they haven't come to terms with the sources or haven't looked at the right materials. That helps create this confusion. And so what happens is that... The early church, the New Testament writers, they get blamed, in effect, for our misunderstandings. And so we push them into the corner and make them say things they didn't mean to say. What Jesus was talking about, Tom Wright calls it the climax of the covenant. And that is, in Christ, God has achieved this is the climax. It's reached this goal, and now we're in a period of time of outworking as God wraps things up the way he wants to. But it's not like an end of the world, like the world blows up or comes to an end that Christians were expecting, and then it didn't happen. And that's a modern misreading. And then we think that that's what the early Christians were talking about, and then we find fault with them for being wrong. And it's really our mistake in the first place.
So it says, as we talked recently with Bishop Wright, and I think he said in the course of our conversation that often the conclusions of, as you call them, old school and new school skeptics in biblical scholarship tells us more about the skeptics than it does about the New Testament or Scripture or the early church.
Exactly so. And so what happens is some people go into a Bible study or thinking about Christian origins, and they've got some very faulty ideas. And then as they do their more critical study, they grow up, as it were, they go to school, they do graduate studies, and the Bible doesn't seem to deliver what they were expecting it to, and so they lose confidence in it. But that's because they were asking the wrong questions and looking for the wrong things in the first place. And that's what I'm trying to point out in that chapter where I talk about skeptics. They're starting from the wrong place so often. And because the Bible doesn't appear to deliver on their terms, they say, oh, my goodness, my faith just went out the window. I don't know what to think anymore. And they're very discouraged and go off on another path or something like that.
What's the difference between, and these again are your terms, the old school skeptics and the new school skeptics?
Well, I think the new school skepticism is a lot more radical. Old school skeptics were a lot more sober in their assessment of the sources. And so, like Rudolf Bultmann, he didn't think for one second that the Gospel of Thomas or some of the other apocryphal Gospels that gained so much notoriety and attention now, he didn't think for one second that those writings were older and more reliable than, say, the New Testament Gospels. He never thought that. And yet, of course, Bultmann was no evangelical. He was no conservative by any stretch. And so there was a skepticism of a different nature, but more sobriety in the logic as well. And some of these new skeptics, they really do throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so, oh my goodness, it doesn't look like I can harmonize these gospels, and I can't harmonize this and that. Wow, I guess Jesus didn't say any of it. Or let me take it another step, like Bob Price. Maybe Jesus didn't exist at all. I mean, it's that kind of, the old school skeptics didn't leap to radical conclusions like that. They were skeptical, to be sure. I don't agree with them on certain points. But these new age skeptics, you might say, new school skeptics, they are a different brand altogether.
Well, let's use Ehrman as an example. You tell his story, and I think he even told his own story when we talked with him, coming up from a fundamentalist background,
I believe.
Right. He seemed to be shocked when he learned that the text of the New Testament actually had textual variants in it. It shook his faith.
I know. I find that puzzling. He emailed me, too, by the way, when he read that chapter. And he thought, oh, well, you're compressing it. You're making it too simplistic. And I've reread portions of his work, and no, actually not. He does talk about his loss of faith for other reasons. Such as suffering in the world, and that's an old one that's been around a long time. But he does clearly state that he was, like you put it, very surprised and consternated over the fact that uh, There seem to be these discrepancies and scribal errors. And, of course, he really makes a point out of that in his Misquoting Jesus book. And, you know, and so it comes to, he leads to the conclusion or wants the reader to come to the conclusion that there are so many scribal errors in the manuscript tradition, we have no confidence whatsoever that we actually have anything close to the original text. And it's that kind of stuff. It's uncalled for. And, you know, he went to Moody Bible Institute. Now, sure, it's conservative and everything, but he'd learned about that stuff even back then. And certainly at Wheaton College and Wheaton Graduate School, he didn't have to go to Princeton and study with Bruce Metzger to find out there are scribal errors in the manuscripts. And so I find that very, very puzzling, his the way he tries to argue. And in the end, I'm not convinced by that at all. I think, you know, there was something else that got Bart off the rails. It can't possibly have just been some scribal errors like that. I mean, is he that brittle? I mean, it really leaves me puzzled.
You talked about beginning with the skeptics have in common that they ask the wrong questions, they begin with the wrong questions. What are some of the common presuppositions, sometimes unstated presuppositions, sometimes stated, of skeptical scholarship about the person of Jesus?
Well, what partly happens is there's a philosophical worldview that kicks in, and that is very, very suspicious of any kind of supernatural element. And that really poisons the well right off. And so it's there's a condescension and an arrogance on our part. We're moderns. We're scientific. Nobody else was. And so the last 200 years, we're real smart. We're very scientific, only in the West, of course. And so the rest of humanity for all time and everywhere else in the world, they don't know what they're doing. They're gullible. They're naive and so on. And the Bible's part of that world. And so, obviously, if the Bible writers say something like Jesus walked on water, multiplied loaves, restored sight to someone who was blind, well, we who know better know that couldn't have happened, so this must not be history. And so there's that kind of philosophical backdrop that prejudices the whole discussion from the outset, and that's what creates the problem. And so here you have these Gospels, several of them, other people, not even Christians, Josephus and others, who describe Jesus as just an amazing healer. And so some people try to explain it away and say, well, he must be in league with the devil. I can't explain it otherwise. Others, oh, no, he's God's son. He's supernatural in a very positive way. The Spirit of God is at work in him. Others are indifferent. They're not sure. They just know that whatever it is, he can do it. And so I think a fair-minded person says, well, you know, there's pretty significant testimony here, and we shouldn't condescend to people in late antiquity and assume they're all naive or they can't tell the truth. And that we should be historians and say, look at this. This is a pretty good testimony here. This is pretty good witness here. And go from there instead of imposing our modern worldview that makes some pretty surprising claims. Namely, we know there is either no God at all or he never does anything that would make himself revealed in any special way. And so we assume that, and because the Gospels then don't match that expectation, we accuse them of being unhistorical. And I don't think that's a fair way of proceeding on our part.
What I find a little bit irritating, and I've talked with John Dominic Crossan, and I said Ehrman before, and several others. The attitude, it's not a personal attitude that they hold, but it's an attitude that comes across in essentially their arguments, which is the average person might get fooled when reading the New Testament into thinking that this is all just ordinary narrative and history. But we scholars know better. And we are able to read it in such a way to discover, kind of to do the demythologizing job, the Rudolf Bultmann demythologizing job. We're able to read it at such a level, at such a depth, that we can see through all the smoke and mirrors of what just appears to be ordinary narrative and honest history.
Yeah, I know. I've encountered that, too. And it's very arrogant and very condescending on our part when people, when I say our, you know, I'm talking about all of us. As scholars and as theologians, and you know, we really need to guard against talking that way and thinking that way, because what we're really saying is that people 2,000 years ago were stupid and also were dishonest. They couldn't tell the truth, and they couldn't even recognize the truth if they saw it. And that's all because of our philosophical disposition, which is a relatively recent, you know, this skepticism with respect to the world of spirit and supernatural is a relatively recent phenomenon, just in the last couple hundred years, and it's a very localized phenomenon. It's a Western thing. But the whole of humanity, the whole of human history, and right up to the present time, most of the world, 80 or 90% of it, does not think that way. So it's our hang-up. It's a modern thing. It's a Western thing. And we ought to stop talking that way, because the world is an amazingly complex place, and science is showing that. And science continues to push the boundaries back and realizes, my goodness, reality is very, very complicated, and we've been reductionistic, materialistic, simplistic, in thinking that we understand what reality is, and we have somehow excluded God, we've excluded the Holy Spirit, we've excluded the supernatural, because we're so smart and can explain everything. And that's naivete and arrogance on our part.
Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. We're talking about distortions of the Gospels and of Jesus Christ by some modern scholarship. He's Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Wolfville, Nova Scotia, Canada, author of the new book Fabricating Jesus, How Modern Scholars Distort the Gospels. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and you can email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Let's go to the phones and talk with Steve, who calls from his car. Hi, Steve.
How you doing?
Very well.
You know, I'm thinking of this discussion. If you take a step back, if you're going to apply this logic to apply to the New Testament, well, I guess we need to apply to all of antiquity. So it's basically, if there's any history at all, that say in the Odyssey, we can pitch it. We should treat the Greek philosophers as lucky at best for coming up with some brilliant ideas. But you know, if all human knowledge is manifest in the 19th, 20th, 21st century, then we could pretty much debunk everything before that.
Steve, thank you very much. What do you make of it, Dr. Evans?
Well, Steve's made a very good point. That's true. And what happens is we become rather selective in our debunking, depending on whatever our philosophical disposition, whatever the flavor of the month happens to be. And so as long as Plato or as long as Socrates or as long as some great philosopher or ethicist from antiquity is talking about something that doesn't bother us and it does not conflict with our current worldview, then we show them respect. But as soon as they move into an area that we don't understand or we don't like or want to debunk or whatever it is, then we show them no respect. And it's that kind of selectivity that annoys me. And, you know, there were a lot of people in antiquity that were aware that God did things from time to time, unexplained occurrences, healings, miraculous events. Those events are still described by credible sources in this very day. Anybody that's been, you know, maybe not in New York City, so to speak, but out and about around the world, third world and so on. And so it's that continuity that's still there that we in our little ivory tower, we Western academics, fail to observe.
Let's go back to the phones. Mark is calling from his car. Mark, welcome.
Good evening. I was wondering if this same kind of attitude leads to a denial of the Holocaust. In other words, if they haven't laid the philosophical groundwork that other people use to deny another historical event, the Holocaust.
All right, thank you very much. Can their logic be turned that direction?
You know, that's a very good comment. Good for Mark. Bravo. Good observation. I find parallels between those who say Jesus didn't exist. I mean, you actually have web pages, and Todd, I'm sure you know this. You've probably visited some of them. They're ridiculous. The Jesus never existed, you know, .com kind of a web page. And the sloppy, silly, question-begging type of approach to history and evidence is very similar to Holocaust deniers. They don't care what the eyewitnesses say. They say all of the evidence, even films, are put up jobs, and evidence is, in a very gratuitous way, is pushed aside, and a very implausible hypothesis is put forward, whether it's the Holocaust didn't happen or Jesus never existed. And I think that is an interesting parallel, and I think there's a parallel attitude of some sort that's operating behind it.
We've talked a bit about how some skeptical scholarship of yesterday and today treat the actual text of the New Testament vis-a-vis Jesus. They also have a real penchant for extra-scriptural sources, especially those more ancient sources that claim to be other revelations regarding Jesus Christ. Tell us about them.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the things that is so funny about our business. You can find New Testament scholars, biblical scholars, whether we're talking Old Testament, New Testament, or whatever, that can be so severe and so critical and so skeptical. And, oh, I don't know if this really happened, and I don't know if this can be trusted, and, you know, that kind of thing. And then along comes some strange, interesting but oddball document from a later period of time, and it's treated with a lot of respect. And, well, you know, we might have something pretty early here. Well, you know, this might actually reach back to the 30s or 40s in Jesus's, you know, in the early church in Palestine. And, well, what do you know? And so the Gospel of Judas, which, or not the Gospel of Judas, but the Gospel of Thomas, probably dates to like 175 or 180. Well, you know, we can smuggle it into the middle of the first century. And I find that such an odd, such a strange inconsistency. It's so curious. That's why in the book, Fabricating Jesus, I couldn't put it all into one chapter. It had to become two chapters because that is really a big part of this whole problem, is this lionizing gospels and related sources outside of the New Testament and making the public think that they really do unlock for the reading public today special new insights, fast track back to the historical Jesus that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John don't do. And that is a big part of the problem.
The average person, upon discovering that there's such a thing as a Gospel of Thomas that has an ancient pedigree, Gospel of Judas, and all the others that you mention in your book, might be a little surprised. And some of these scholars are quick with an explanation, and that is, well, don't you know that these documents were suppressed as an organized effort by the early church so that they could push their Jesus forward to us?
Oh, I know. All that is a sophisticated form of Dan Brown. That's Dan Brown with a couple of footnotes. And it's just not persuasive. You know, where is this coordinated, concerted effort? Yeah, you have the odd church father, the odd apologist who writes a work and is recommending that certain heretical books not be read, and argues passionately in defense of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Paul's letters, the book of Acts, in other words, the stuff that we call the New Testament, but as if this is some kind of, I mean, we're talking about writings in the second and third centuries. Christianity has no official standing. Christianity does not have at that time the power to gather up anybody's books and burn them. And Constantine in the 4th century did no such thing, even though Brown and Da Vinci Code asserts that. So I don't know where all this is coming from. What it is it's an open, freewheeling debate among individual Christians, but also congregations and bishops who oversee clusters of congregations in given regions. And they're critically assessing, in ways I wish modern scholars would, you know, follow the example, they're critically assessing the documents that are floating around and claim to be gospel and claim to be apostolic and so on. And I think the church judged very, very well. They identified the four that we have in the New Testament, and as far as I know, and all the critical work that's been done, they're the only four that are from the first century. They're the only four with credible eyewitness and, in some cases, apostolic linkage. Everything else is second century or later, and it's not from Palestine or with Palestinian roots. So we're talking about other documents that are second, third, 4th century, and for the most part, from other parts of the world. I think the early church has demonstrated that it was very perceptive and exercised excellent judgment in choosing the four Gospels it chose. I see no reason for adjusting the canon, including the Gospel of Thomas as a fifth Gospel, for example, which the Jesus Seminar would like to talk about. I don't see any reason for that at all.
Okay, very quickly, with only a minute, you mentioned Jesus Seminar. We started out talking about Bart Ehrman. They do have one thing in common, many things in common, but this in common. Bart Ehrman was quite happy to admit on this program that he does not have an objective basis. He doesn't even want to talk about objective truth any longer for his scholarly conclusions. You see these guys dropping beads into a bowl to decide what Jesus said or didn't say. That's not objective scholarship. Is this truly scholarship in the best sense of the word?
No, it's not scholarship in the best sense at all. And I'm editing an encyclopedia of the historical Jesus, and that'll be coming out in a year or so. And there's an entry in it on the Jesus Seminar. Bruce Chilton is the author of it. Bruce is at Bard College. It is one of the most insightful and incisive criticisms of the Jesus Seminar I've ever read, and he freely talks about arm twisting, Robert Funk, personal views and preferences, and a lot of stuff that would never pass muster as genuine scholarship in casting these beads and trying to argue for what they think was authentic and what they think wasn't. And I think the thing was borderline sham.
Dr. Craig Evans has a website. It's craigevans.com, craigevans.com. He's Distinguished Professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Wolfville, Nova Scotia, Canada, author of the new book, Fabricating Jesus, How Modern Scholars Distort the Gospels. His website, craigevans.com. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Well, when we come back from this break, we've got hour three straight ahead. And during hour three, we're going to do three things. That's nice. Third hour, three things. Rocky Hulse will join us for a few minutes. We'll talk about Mormonism and Christianity. He's going to be making a presentation on Mormonism Sunday at 4 at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, and he's president of the Nauvoo Christian Visitor Center in Nauvoo, Illinois. We're going to be playing Soundbite of the Week at the very end of this next hour, and you'll hear another soundbite coming out of this break. That means you just listen to the soundbites we have for you. And you choose your soundbite of the week and give us a call and tell us why, or email us and tell us why. And then, right after our conversation with Rocky Hulse, audio open lines, very interesting comment from a listener to Sunday night's nationally syndicated edition of Issues, Etc. We were talking about the ordination of women, and we were talking about evangelical feminism with Wayne Grudem, and we got this comment. We want to share it with you and get your reaction. That's audio open lines on the other side of this break. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. During that little bit of audio open lines and that comment from a listener on women's ordination, you're going to hear all sorts of accusations about what we had to say with Dr. Wayne Grudem on the ordination of women, or you can listen for yourself tomorrow. We'll talk about evangelical feminism with Dr. Wayne Grudem and Dr. Peter Scare. And that's tomorrow on Issues, Etc. Then Sunday night on the program, Pastor Brent Kuhlman is going to be our guest. We're going to talk about eternal rewards. There's so much talk out there about eternal rewards, especially with Rick Warren's book, The Purpose-Driven Life. What does Scripture have to say? That's Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.